His voice was not like his face. It had gentleness to it. Magnus managed to hide his surprise and raise his eyebrows in silent inquiry. He had not lived 300 years without learning not to rise to every bait offered.
"You're Magnus Bane."
Magnus hesitated, then inclined his head.
"And you are?"
"I," the boy announced, "am James Herondale."
"You know," Magnus murmured, "I rather thought you might be called something like that. I'm delighted to hear that I'm famous. You're my father's warlock friend. He would always speak of you to my sister and me whenever other shadow hunters spoke slightingly of downworlders in our presence. He would say he knew a warlock who was a better friend and more worth trusting than many a Nephilim warrior." The boy's lips curled as he said it, and he spoke mockingly but with more contempt than amusement behind the mockery, as if his father had been a fool to tell him this, and James himself was a fool to repeat it. Magnus found himself in no mood for cynicism. They had parted well, he and Will, but he knew shadow hunters. The Nephilim were swift to judge and condemn a downworlder for ill deeds, acting as if every sin were graven in stone for all time, proving that Magnus's people were evil by nature. Shadow hunters' conviction of their own angelic virtue and righteousness made it easy for them to let a warlock's good deeds slip their minds, as if they were written in water. He had not expected to see or hear of Will Herondale on this journey, but if Magnus had thought of it, he would have been unsurprised to be all but forgotten, a petty player in a boy's tragedy. Being remembered, and remembered so kindly, touched him more than he would have thought possible. The boy's star-shining, burning city eyes traveled across Magnus's face and saw too much. "I would not set any great store by it. My father trusts a great many people," James Herondale said and laughed.
It was quite clear, suddenly, that he was extremely drunk. Not that Magnus had imagined he was firing at chandeliers while stone-cold sober.
"Trust. It's like placing a blade in someone's hand and setting the very point against your own heart."
"I have not asked you to trust me," Magnus pointed out mildly. "We have just met."
"Oh, I'll trust you," the boy told him carelessly. "It hardly matters. We are all betrayed sooner or later. All betrayed. All traitors."
"I see that a flair for the dramatic runs in the blood," Magnus said under his breath. It was a different kind of dramatics, though. Will had made an exhibition of vice in private to drive away those nearest and dearest to him. James was making a public spectacle. Perhaps he loved vice for vice's own sake.
"What?"
James asked.
"Nothing," said Magnus. "I was merely wondering what the chandelier had done to offend you."
James looked up at the ruined chandelier and down at the shards of glass at his feet, as if he were noticing them only now.
"I was bet," he said, £20 that I would not shoot out all the lights of the chandelier."
"And who bet you?"
said Magnus, not divulging a hint of what he thought, that anyone who bet a drunk 17-year-old boy that he could wave around a deadly weapon with impunity ought to be in jail.
"That fellow there," James announced, pointing.
Magnus looked in the general direction James was gesturing toward and spied a familiar face at the faro table.
"The green one?" Magnus inquired.
Coaxing drunken shadow hunters into making fools of themselves was a favorite occupation among the downworlders, and this performance had been a tremendous success. Ragnar Fell, the High Warlock of London, shrugged, and Magnus sighed inwardly. Perhaps jail would be a bit extreme, though Magnus still felt his emerald friend could use taking down a peg or two.
"Is he really green?"
James asked, not seeming to care over much.
"I thought that was the absinthe."
Then James Herondale, son of William Herondale and Teresa Gray, the two shadow hunters who had been the closest of their kind to friends that Magnus had ever known, though Tessa had not been quite a shadow hunter, or not entirely, turned his back on Magnus, set his sights on a woman serving drinks to a table surrounded by werewolves, and shot her down. She collapsed on the floor with a cry, and all the gamblers sprang from their tables, cards flying and drinks spilling. James laughed, and the laugh was clear and bright, and it was then that Magnus began to be truly alarmed. Will's voice would have shaken, betraying that this cruelty had been part of his acting, but his son's laugh was that of someone genuinely delighted by the chaos erupting all around him. Magnus's hand shot out and grasped the boy's wrist, the hum and light of magic crackling along his fingers like a promise. "That's enough." "Be easy," James said, still laughing. "I'm a very good shot, and Peg the tavern maid is famous for her wooden leg. I think that is why they call her Peg. Her real name, I believe, is Ermintrude. And I suppose Ragnar Fell bet you 20 pounds that you couldn't shoot her without managing to draw blood. How very clever of you both." James drew his hand back from Magnus's, shaking his head. His black locks fell around a face so like his father's that it prompted an indrawn breath from Magnus. "My father told me you acted as a sort of protector to him, but I do not need your protection, warlock. I rather disagree with that." "I have taken a great many bets tonight," James Herondale informed him. "I must perform all the terrible deeds I have promised, for am I not a man of my word? I want to preserve my honor, and I want another drink." "What an excellent idea," Magnus said. "I have heard alcohol only improves a man's aim. The night is young. Imagine how many barmaids you can shoot before dawn."
"A warlock as dull as a scholar," said James, narrowing his amber eyes. "Who would have thought such a thing existed?"
"Magnus has not always been so dull," said Ragnar, appearing at James's shoulder with a glass of wine in hand. He gave it to the boy, who took it and downed it in a distressingly practiced manner. "There was a time in Peru with a boat full of pirates." James wiped his mouth on his sleeve and set down his glass. "I should love to sit and listen to old men reminiscing about their lives, but I have a pressing appointment to do something that is actually interesting. Another time, chaps." He turned upon his heel and left. Magnus made to follow him. "Let the Nephilim control their brat if they can," Ragnar said, always happy to see chaos but not be involved in it. "Come, have a drink with me." "Another night," Magnus promised. "Still such a soft touch, Magnus," Ragnar called after him. "Nothing you like better than a lost soul or a bad idea." Magnus wanted to argue with that, but it was difficult when he was already forsaking warmth and the promise of a drink and a few rounds of cards, and running out into the cold after a deranged shadow hunter. Said deranged shadow hunter turned on him as if the narrow cobbled street were a cage and he some wild, hungry animal held there too long. "I wouldn't follow me," James warned. "I'm in no mood for company, especially the company of a prim magical chaperone who does not know how to enjoy himself." "I know perfectly well how to enjoy myself," remarked Magnus, amused, and he made a small gesture so that for an instant all the iron street lamps lining the street rained down vari-colored sparks of light. For an instant, he thought he saw a light that was softer and less like burning in James Herondale's golden eyes, the beginnings of a childlike smile of delight. The next moment, it was quenched. James's eyes were as bright as the jewels in a dragon's hoard, and no more alive or joyful. He shook his head, black locks flying in the night air, where the magic lights were fading. "But you do not wish to enjoy yourself, do you, James Herondale?" Magnus asked. "Not really. You want to go to the devil." "Perhaps I think I will enjoy going to the devil," said James Herondale, and his eyes burned like the fires of hell, enticing and promising unimaginable suffering. "Though I see no need to take anyone else with me." No sooner had he spoken than he vanished, to all appearances softly and silently stolen away by the night air, with no one but the winking stars, the glaring street lamps, and Magnus as witnesses. Magnus knew magic when he saw it. He spun, and at the same moment heard the click of a decided footstep against a cobblestone. He turned to face a policeman walking his beat, truncheon swinging at his side and a look of suspicion on his stolid face as he surveyed Magnus. It was not Magnus the man had to watch out for. Magnus saw the buttons on the man's uniform cease their gleaming, even though he was under a street lamp. Magnus was able to discern a shadow falling where there was nothing to cast it, a surge of dark within the greater darkness of the night. The policeman gave a shout of surprise as his helmet was whisked away by unseen hands. He stumbled forward, hands fumbling blindly in the air to retrieve what was long gone. Magnus gave him a consoling smile. "Cheer up," he said. "You can find far more flattering headgear at any shop on Bond Street." The man fainted. Magnus considered pausing to help him, but there was being a soft touch and then there was being ridiculous enough not to pursue a most enticing mystery. A shadow hunter who could turn into a shadow. Magnus turned and bolted after the bobbing policeman's helmet, held aloft only by a taunting darkness. They ran down street after street, Magnus and the darkness, until the Thames barred their path. Magnus heard the sound of its rushing swiftness rather than saw it, the dark waters at one with the night. What he did see were white fingers suddenly clenched on the brim of the policeman's helmet, the turn of James Herondale's head, darkness replaced with the tilt of his slowly appearing grin. Magnus saw a shadow coalescing once more into flesh. So the boy had inherited something from his mother, as well as his father then. Tessa's father had been a fallen angel, one of the kings of demons. The boy's lambent golden eyes seemed to Magnus like his own eyes suddenly, a token of infernal blood. James saw Magnus looking and winked before he hurled the helmet up into the air. It flew for a moment like a strange bird spinning gently around in the air, then hit the water. The darkness was disrupted by a silver splash. "A shadow hunter who knows magic tricks," Magnus observed. "How novel." A shadow hunter who attacked the mundanes it was his mandate to protect. How delighted the clay would be by that. "We are but dust and shadows, as the saying goes," said James. "Of course, the saying does not add, some of us also turn into shadows occasionally when the mood takes us. I suppose nobody predicted that I would come to pass. It's true that I have been told I am somewhat unpredictable. May I ask who bet you that you could steal a policeman's helmet, and why?" "Foolish question. Never ask about the last bet, Bane," James advised him and reached casually to his belt where his gun was slung and then drew it in one fluid, easy motion. "You should be worrying about the next one." "There isn't any chance," Magnus asked without much hope, "that you are rather a nice fellow who believes he is cursed and must make himself seem unlovable to spare those around him from a terrible fate, because I have heard that happens sometimes." James seemed amused by the question. He smiled, and as he smiled, his waving black locks blended with the night, and the glow of his skin and his eyes grew as distant as the light of the stars until they became so pale they diffused. He was nothing but a shadow among shadows again. He was an infuriating Cheshire cat of a boy. Nothing left of him but the impression of his smile. "My father was cursed," James said from the darkness. "Whereas I'm damned." The London Institute was exactly as Magnus remembered it, tall and white and imposing, its tower cutting a white line against the dark sky. Shadow Hunter Institutes were built as monuments to withstand the ravages of demons and time. When the doors opened, Magnus beheld again the massive stone entryway and the two flights of stairs. A woman with wildly curling red hair, whom Magnus was sure he should remember but didn't, answered the door, her face creased with sleep and crossness.
"What do you want, Warlock?"
she demanded. Magnus shifted the burden in his arms. The boy was tall, and Magnus had had a long night besides. Annoyance made his tone rather sharp as he answered.
I want you to go tell Will Herondale that I've brought his whelp home. The woman's eyes widened. She gave an impressed sort of whistle and vanished abruptly.
A handful of moments later, Magnus saw a white figure come softly down one of the staircases. Tessa was like the Institute, hardly changed at all. She had the same smooth, youthful face that she had worn 25 years before. Magnus thought she must have stopped aging no more than 3 or 4 years after he had last seen her. Her hair was in a long brown plait hanging over one shoulder, and she was holding a witch light in one hand and had a small sphere of light shining in her palm in the other.
Been taking magic lessons, have we, Tessa? Magnus asked.
Magnus? Tessa exclaimed, and her grave face lit with a welcoming smile that sent a pang of sweetness through Magnus.
But they said...
Oh, no. Oh, where did you find Jamie?
She reached the bottom of the steps, went over to Magnus and cradled the boy's damp head in her hand in an almost absent-minded gesture of affection. In that gesture, Magnus saw how she had changed, saw the ingrained habit of motherhood, love for someone she had created and whom she cherished. No other warlock would ever have a child of their own blood. Only Tessa could have that experience. Magnus turned his head away from Tessa at the sound of a new footfall on the stairs. The memory of Will, the boy, was so fresh that it was something of a shock to see Will himself now, older, broader of shoulder, but still with the same tousled black hair and laughing blue eyes. He looked just as handsome as he had ever been. More so, perhaps, since he seemed so much happier. Magnus saw more marks of laughter than of time on his face, and found himself smiling. It was true what Will had said, he realized. They were friends. Recognition crossed Will's face, and with it pleasure, but almost instantly he saw the burden Magnus carried, and worry erased all else.
Magnus, he said, what on earth happened to James?
What happened? Magnus asked musingly. Well, let me see. He stole a bicycle and rode it, not using his hands at any point through Trafalgar Square. He attempted to climb Nelson's column and fight with Nelson. Then I lost him for a brief period of time, and by the time I caught up with him, he had wandered into Hyde Park, waded into the Serpentine, spread his arms wide, and was shouting, "Ducks, embrace me as your king."
Dear God, said Will. He must have been vilely drunk. Tessa, I can bear it no longer. He is taking awful risks with his life and rejecting all the principles I hold most dear. If he continues making an exhibition of himself throughout London, he will be called to Idris and kept there away from the mundanes. Does he not realize that?
Magnus shrugged.
He also made inappropriate amorous advances to a startled grandmotherly sort selling flowers. An Irish wolfhound, an innocent hat stand in a dwelling he broke into, and myself. I will add that I do not believe his admiration of my person, dazzling though I am, to be sincere. He told me I was a beautiful, sparkling lady. Then he abruptly collapsed, naturally in the path of an oncoming train from Dover, and I decided it was well past time to take him home and place him in the bosom of his family. If you had rather I put him in an orphanage, I fully understand.
Will was shaking his head, shadows in his blue eyes now.
Bridget! He shouted, and Magnus thought, oh yes, that was the maid's name. Call for the Silent Brothers, Will finished.
You mean call for Jem? Tessa said, dropping her voice, and she and Will shared a look, what Magnus could describe only as a married look. The look of two people who understood each other completely and yet found each other adorable all the same. It was quite sickening. He cleared his throat.
Still a silent brother, then, is he?
Will gave Magnus a withering look.
It does tend to be a permanent state. Here, give me my son.
Magnus let Will take James from his arms, which were left lighter, if more damp, and Magnus followed Will's and Tessa's lead up the stairs. Inside the Institute, it was clear they had been redecorating. Charlotte's dark drawing room now held several comfortable-looking sofas, and the walls were covered in light damask. Tall shelves were lined with books, volumes with the gilt rubbed off their spines, and Magnus was sure the pages much-thumbed. It appeared both Tessa and Will remained great readers. Will deposited James onto one of the sofas. Tessa rushed to find a blanket as Magnus turned toward the door, only to find his hand caught in Will's grasp.
"It was very good of you to bring Jamie home," Will said. "But you were always so good to me and mine. I was little more than a boy then, and not as grateful or as gracious as I should have been."
"You were well enough, Will," said Magnus. "And I see you have grown to be better. Also, you're not bald, and neither have you grown fat. All that dashing about and fighting evil you people do is at least useful for keeping a trim figure in middle age," Will laughed.
"It's very good to see you too," he hesitated. "About Jamie."
Magnus tensed. He had not wanted to distress Will and Tessa too much. He had not told them that James had fallen when he was in the Serpentine and made very little effort to rescue himself from drowning. He had not seemed to want to be taken from the cold depths of water, had fought Magnus as he dragged him out, then laid his pale cheek against the dank earth of the riverbank and hid his face in his arms.
For a moment, Magnus had thought he was crying, but as he stooped down to check on the boy, he found he was barely conscious. With his cruel, golden eyes closed, he once again reminded Magnus of the lost boy Will had been. Magnus touched his damp hair gently and said,
"James?"
in as kind a voice as he could.
The boy's pale hands were splayed against the dark earth. The glimmer of the Herondale ring shone against his skin, and the edge of something metallic shone under his sleeve as well. His eyes were shut, the black lashes ink-dark crescents against the lines of his cheekbones. Sparkling drops of water were caught in the curling ends of those lashes, which made him look unhappy in a way he did not when awake.
"Grace,"
James had whispered in his sleep, and was silent. Magnus had not been angry. He had found himself wishing for a benevolent grace many times himself. He bent and gathered the boy up in his arms. His head lolled against Magnus's shoulder. In sleep, James had looked peaceful and innocent and wholly human.
"This just isn't like him,"
Will was saying now as Tessa drew a blanket up over the boy, tucking him in firmly.
Magnus raised an eyebrow.
"He's your son." "What are you trying to imply?"
Will demanded, and for a moment Magnus saw his eyes flash, and saw the boy with messy black hair and glaring blue eyes standing in his drawing room, furious at the whole world, and at no part of it more than himself.
"It isn't like him," Tessa agreed. "He's always been so quiet, so studious. Lucy was the impetuous one, but they are both kind, good-hearted children. At parties, Jamie could most often be found curled up in a corner with his Latin, or laughing at a private joke with his parabatai. He always kept Matthew out of trouble as well as himself. He was the only one who could make that indolent boy attend his studies,"
she remarked with a slight smile that betokened she was fond of her son's parabatai no matter what his faults.
"Now he's out at all hours doing the most disgraceful things, and he will not listen to reason. He will not listen to anybody. I understand what you mean about Will, but Will was lonely and wretched in the days when he behaved badly. James has been wrapped in love all his life."
"Betrayed," Will muttered. "Cruelly maligned by my friend and now by my own cherished wife. Scorned, my name blackened."
"I see you're still fond of histrionics, Will," said Magnus. "As well as still handsome." They had grown up. Neither of them looked startled at all. Tessa raised her eyebrows, and Magnus saw something of her son in her then. They both had the same expressive arched brows, giving their faces a look of both inquiry and amusement, though in James's face the amusement was bitter.
"Do stop flirting with my husband," said Tessa.
"I shall not," Magnus declared. "But I will pause briefly so that I may catch up on your news. I have not heard from you since you sent word the baby had arrived and both he and his lovely mother were thriving."
Will looked surprised.
"But we sent you several letters in care of the Morgensterns, who were going to visit the Whitelaws at the New York Institute. It was you who proved to be a shocking correspondent."
"Ah," said Magnus. He himself was not even slightly surprised. This was typical behavior from shadow hunters.
"The Morgensterns must have forgotten to deliver them. How careless."
Tessa, he saw, did not look too surprised either. She was both warlock and shadow hunter, and yet not quite either. The shadow hunters believed that shadow hunter blood trumped all else. But Magnus could well believe that many of the Nephilim might be unkind to a woman who could do magic and whom the years did not touch. He doubted any of them dared be unkind in front of Will, though.
"We will be most careful about whom we entrust with our letters in future," Tessa said decisively. "We have been out of touch for far too long. How fortunate that you are here in London, both for us and for Jamie. What brings you here? Business or pleasure?"
"I wish it were the business of pleasure," Magnus told her. "But no, it's very dull. A shadow hunter I believe you know sent for me. Tatiana Blackthorne? The lady used to be a Lightwood, did she not?"
Magnus turned to Will.
"And your sister, Cecily, married her brother, Gilbert Gaston? I have a shocking memory for Lightwoods. I begged Cecily not to throw herself away on a lightworm," Will muttered.
"Will," said Tessa, "Cecily and Gabriel are very happy together."
Will threw himself dramatically into an armchair, touching his son's wrist as he passed by with a light, careful caress that spoke volumes.
"At least you must admit, Tess, that Tatiana is as mad as a mouse trapped in a teapot. She refuses to speak to any of us, and that includes her brothers, because she says we had a hand in her father's death. Actually, she says we pitilessly slew him. Everybody tries to point out that at the time of the pitiless slaying, her father was a giant worm who had eaten her husband and followed up his meal with a palate-cleansing servant sorbet. But she insists on lurking about the manor house and sulking with all the curtains drawn."
"She has lost a great deal. She lost a child," Tessa said. She stroked back her son's hair, her face troubled. Will looked to James and fell silent.
"Mrs. Blackthorne has come from Idris to her family manor in England specifically so I might visit her, and she sent me a message through the usual downworlder channels promising me a princely sum if I would come and cast a few spells to increase the attractions of her young ward," Magnus said, attempting to strike a lighter note. "I gather she wishes to marry her off."
Tatiana would not be the first shadow hunter to seek a warlock spell to make her life easier and more pleasant. She was, however, the shadow hunter offering the best price.
"Did she?" Will asked. "The poor girl must look like a toad in a bonnet."
Tessa laughed and stifled the laugh against her hand, and Will grinned, looking pleased with himself, as he always had when he managed to amuse Tessa.
"I suppose I shouldn't be casting aspersions on anybody else's children, since my son is all about in his wit. He shoots things, you know. He made quite a scene at the Ascot Derby Day when he spotted an unfortunate woman wearing a hat he thought had too much wax fruit on it."
"I did know that he shoots things," Magnus said tactfully.
"Yes."
Will sighed.
"The angel grant me patience so I do not strangle him, and wisdom so I can talk some sense into his great fat head."
"I do wonder where he gets it from," said Magnus pointedly.
"It's not the same," said Tessa. "When Will was Jamie's age, he tried to drive everyone he loved away.
Jamie is as loving as ever to us, to Lucy, to his Parabatai. It is himself he wishes to destroy.
And yet, there is no reason for it, Will said, striking the arm of his chair with his clenched fist. I know my son. He would not behave this way unless he felt he had no other choice, unless he was trying to achieve a goal or punish himself in some way because he felt he had done some wrong.
You called for me? I am here.
Magnus looked up to see Brother Zachariah standing in the doorway. He was a slender outline, the hood of his robe down, baring his face. The Silent Brothers rarely bared their faces, knowing how most shadow hunters reacted to the scars and disfigurement of their skin. It was a sign of trust that Jem showed himself to Will and Tessa in this way. Jem was still Jem. Like Tessa, he had not aged. The Silent Brothers were not immortal, but aged incredibly slowly. The powerful runes that gave them knowledge and allowed them to speak with their minds also slowed their bodies' aging, turning the brothers to living statues. Jem's hands were pale and slender under the cuffs of his robe. Still musician's hands, after all this time. His face seemed carved out of marble, his eyes shuttered crescents. The dark runes of the brothers standing out on his high cheekbones. His hair waved around his temples, darkness shot with silver. A great sadness welled up in Magnus at the sight of him. It was human to age and die, and Jem stood outside that humanity now, outside the light that burned so brightly and so briefly. It was cold outside that light and fire. No one had greater cause to know that cold than Magnus did. On seeing Magnus, Jem inclined his head.
Magnus Bane, I did not know you would be here.
Magnus began, but Will was already on his feet, striding across the room to Jem. He had lit up at the sight of him, and Magnus could feel Jem's attention move from himself to Will and catch there. Those two boys had been so different, yet at times they had seemed so wholly one that it was strange for Magnus to see Will changed as all humans changed, while Jem was set apart, to see that both had gone somewhere the other could not follow. He imagined it must be even stranger for them. And yet, there was still about them what had always reminded Magnus of an old legend he'd heard of the red thread of fate, that an invisible scarlet thread bound certain people, and however tangled it became, it could not and would not break. The Silent Brothers moved the way one imagined a statue would move if it could. Jem had moved the same way coming in, but as Will neared him, Jem took a step towards his former Parabatai, and the step was swift, eager, and human, as if being close to the people whom he loved made him feel made of flesh and racing blood once more.
You're here,
said Will, and implicit in the words was the sense that Will's contentment was complete. Now Jem was there, all was right with the world.
I knew you would come, said Tessa, rising from her son's side to go after her husband toward Jem. Magnus saw Brother Zachariah's face glow at the sound of her voice, runes and pallor no longer mattering. He was a boy again for an instant, his life just beginning, his heart full of hope and love. How they loved each another, these three, how they had suffered for each another. And yet how much joy they clearly took from simply being in the same room. Magnus had loved before, many times, but he did not ever recall feeling the peace that radiated out from these three only from being in the other's presence. He had craved peace sometimes, like a man wandering for centuries in the desert never seeing water and having to live with the want of it. Tessa, Will and their lost Jem stood together in a tight knot. Magnus knew that for a few moments nothing existed in the world but the three of them. He looked at the sofa where James Herondale lay and saw that he was awake, his gold eyes like watchful flames teaching the candles to burn brightly. James was the young one, the boy with his whole life ahead of him,
but there was no hope or joy in his face. Tessa, Will, and Jem looked natural being together, but even in this room with those who loved him better than life, James looked utterly alone. There was something desperate and desolate about his face. He tried to lean up on one elbow and collapsed back against the cushions of the sofa. His black head tipped back as if it were too heavy for him to bear. Tessa, Will, and Jem were murmuring together, Will's hand on Jem's arm. Magnus had never seen anyone touch a silent brother like that in simple friendship. It made him ache inside, and he saw that hollow ache reflected on the face of the boy on the sofa. Obeying an impetuous impulse, Magnus crossed the room and knelt down by the couch, close to Will's son, who looked at him with tired golden eyes.
You see them, James said, the way they all love one another. I used to think everyone loved that way, the way it is in fairy tales. I used to think that love was giving and generous and good.
And now? Magnus asked. The boy turned his face away. Magnus found himself facing the back of James's head, seeing his mop of black hair so like his father's and the edge of his parabatai rune just under his collar. It must be on his back, Magnus thought, above the blade of his shoulder where an angel's wing would be.
James, said Magnus in a low, hurried voice, once your father had a terrible secret that he thought he could not tell to a soul in the world, and he told me. I can see that there is something gnawing at you, something you were keeping hidden. If there is anything you want to tell me, now or at any time, you have my word that I will keep your secrets and that I will help you if I can.
James shifted to look at Magnus. In his face, Magnus thought he caught a glimpse of softening, as if the boy were releasing his relentless grip on whatever was tormenting him.
I am not like my father, he said. Do not mistake my despair for nobility in disguise, for it is not that. I suffer for myself, not for anyone else.
But why do you suffer? Magnus said in frustration. Your mother was correct when she said you have been loved all your life.
If you would just let me help you.
The boy's expression shut like a door. He turned his face away from Magnus again, and his eyes closed, the light falling on the fringe of his eyelashes.
I gave my word I would never tell, he said, and there is not a living soul on this earth who can help me.
James, Magnus said, honestly surprised by the despair in the boy's tone, and the alarm in Magnus's voice caught the attention of the others in the room. Tessa and Will looked away from Jem to their son, the boy who bore Jem's name, and as one they all moved over to where he lay, Will and Tessa, hand in hand. Brother Zachariah bent over the back of the sofa and touched James's hair, tenderly, with those musician's fingers.
Hello, Uncle Brother Zachariah, James said without opening his eyes. I would say that I'm sorry to bother you, but I'm sure this is the most excitement you've had all year. Not so lively in the City of Bones, now is it?
James, Will snapped. Don't talk to Jem like that.
As if I'm not used to badly behaved Herondales, Brother Zachariah said, in the way Jem had always tried to make peace between Will and the world. I suppose the difference is that Father always cared what you thought about him, said James, and I don't. But don't take it personally, Uncle Jem. I do not care what anybody thinks. And yet he made a habit of making an exhibition of himself, as Will had put it, and Magnus had no doubt it was deliberate. He must care what someone thought. He must be doing all this for a purpose. But what purpose could it be? Magnus wondered.
James, this is so unlike you, Tessa said worriedly. You have always cared, always been kind. What is troubling you?
Perhaps nothing is troubling me. Perhaps I have simply realized I was rather boring before. Don't you think I was boring? All that studying and the Latin? He shuddered.
Horrible.
There is nothing boring about caring or about an open, loving heart, said Jem.
So say all of you, replied James, and it is easy to see why, the three of you falling over yourselves to love one another, each more than the other, and it is kind of you to trouble yourselves about me. His breath caught a little, and then he smiled, but it was a smile of great sadness. I wish I did not trouble you so.
Tessa and Will exchanged looks of despair. The room was thick with worry and parental concern. Magnus was beginning to feel bowed under by the weight of humanity.
Well, he announced, as educational and occasionally damp as this evening has been, I do not wish to intrude on a family reunion, and I really do not wish to experience any family drama. And I find with Shadowhunters that it tends to be extensive. I must be on my way.
But you could stay here, Tessa offered. Be our guest. We would be delighted to have you.
A warlock in the hallowed chambers of a Shadowhunter Institute? Magnus shuddered.
Only think.
Tessa gave him a sharp look.
Magnus. Besides, I have an appointment, Magnus said. One I should not be late for.
Will looked up with a frown.
At this time of night?
I have a peculiar occupation and keep peculiar hours, said Magnus. I seem to recall you coming to me for assistance quite a few times at odd hours of the night. He inclined his head.
Well, Tessa, Jem, good evening.
Tessa moved to his side. I will show you out.
Goodbye, whoever you are, said James, sleepily closing his eyes. I cannot recall your name.
Don't mind him, Tessa said in a low voice as she moved with Magnus towards the exit.
She paused in the doorway for a moment, looking back at her son and the two men who stood with him. Will and Jem were shoulder to shoulder, and from across the room it was impossible to miss Jem's slighter frame, the fact that he had not aged, as Will had. Though there was in Will's voice all the eagerness of a boy when he said, in answer to a question Magnus did not hear,
Why, yes, of course you can play it before you go. It's in the music room, as always, kept ever the same for you.
His violin? Magnus murmured. I did not think the Silent Brothers cared for music.
Tessa sighed softly and moved out into the corridor, Magnus beside her.
Will does not see a Silent Brother when he looks at James, she said. He sees only Jem.
Is it ever difficult? He asked.
Is what difficult?
Sharing your husband's heart so entirely with someone else, he said.
If it were different, it would not be Will's heart, Tessa said. He knows he shares my heart with Jem as well. I would have it no other way, and he would have it no other way with me.
So much a part of one another that there was no way to be untangled even now, and no wish to be so. Magnus wanted to ask if Tessa was ever afraid of what would happen to her when Will was gone, when their bond was finally severed, but he did not. It would with luck be a long time until Tessa's first death, a long time before she entirely realized the burden of being immortal and yet loving that which was not.
Very beautiful, Magnus said instead.
Well, I wish you all the best with your little hellion.
We shall see you again before you leave London, of course,
said Tessa in that tone of hers she had had even as a girl that brooked no contradiction.
Indeed, Magnus said. He hesitated. And Tessa, if you ever need me, and I hope if you do it'll be many long, happy years from now, send me a message and I will be with you at once.
They both knew what he meant.
I will, said Tessa.
She gave him her hand. Hers was small and soft, but her grip was surprisingly strong.
Believe me, dear lady, Magnus told her with an assumption of lightness. He released her hand and bowed with a flourish. Call me, and I come.
As Magnus turned to walk away from the church, he heard the sound of violin music carried to him on the cloudy London air and remembered another night, a night of ghosts and snow and Christmas music, and Will standing on the steps of the Institute, watching Magnus as he went. Now it was Tessa who stood at the door with her hand lifted in farewell until Magnus was at the gate with its lettered message, "We are dust and shadows." He looked back and saw her slight pale figure at the Institute threshold and thought again, yes, perhaps I was wrong to leave London. It was not the first time Magnus had made his way from London to Chiswick to visit Lightwood House. Benedict Lightwood's home had often been thrown open to downworlders who'd been amenable to his idea of a good time. It had been a grand manor once, the stone brilliant white and adorned with Greek statuary and too many pillars to count. The Lightwoods were proud and ostentatious people, and their home in all its neoclassical glory had reflected that. Magnus knew what had become of all that pride. The patriarch, Benedict Lightwood, had contracted a disease from consorting with demons and had transformed into a murderous monster that his own sons had been forced to slay with the assistance of a host of other shadow hunters. Their manor had been taken away by the Clave as punishment, their monies confiscated, and their family had become a laughingstock, a byword for sin and a betrayal of all the shadow hunters held dear. Magnus had little time for the shadow hunters' overweening arrogance, and usually enjoyed seeing them taken down a peg, but even he had rarely seen a family fall so far, so terribly fast. Gabriel and Gideon, Benedict's two sons, had managed to claw their way back to respectability through good behavior and the graces of the consul, Charlotte Branwell. Their sister, however, was another matter entirely. How she had managed to get Lightwood House back into her clutches, Magnus did not know. "As mad as a mouse trapped in a teapot," Will had said of her, and knowing of the family's disgraced state, Magnus hardly expected the grandeur of Benedict's time. Doubtless the place would be shabby now, dusty with time, only a few servants left to keep it up and in order. The carriage Magnus had hired came to a stop. "The place looks abandoned," opined the driver, casting a doubtful eye over the iron gates which looked rusted shut and bound with vines. "Or haunted," Magnus suggested brightly. "Well, I can't get in. Them gates won't open," said the driver gruffly. "You'll have to get out and walk, if you're that determined." Magnus was. His curiosity was alight now, and he approached the gates like a cat, ready to scale them if need be. A tweak of magic, a bit of an opening spell, and the gates burst wide with a shower of rusted metal flakes onto a long, dark, overgrown drive that led up to the ghostly manor house in the distance, glimmering like a tombstone under the full moon. Magnus closed the gates and went forward, listening to the sound of night birds in the trees overhead, the rustle of leaves in the night wind. A forest of blackened tangles loomed all about him. The remains of the famous Lightwood Gardens. Those gardens had been lovely once. Magnus distantly recalled overhearing Benedict Lightwood drunkenly saying that they had been his dead wife's joy. Now the high hedges of the Italian garden had formed a maze, a twisted one from which there was clearly no escape. They had killed the monster Benedict Lightwood had become in these gardens, Magnus remembered hearing, and the black ichor had seeped from the monster's veins into the earth in a dark, unstoppable flood. Magnus felt a scratch against one hand and looked down to see a rosebush that had survived but gone wild. It took him a moment to identify the plant, for though the shape of the blooms was familiar, the color was not. The roses were as black as the blood of the dead serpent. He plucked one. The flower crumbled in his palm as if it were made of ash, as if it had already been dead. Magnus passed on toward the house. The corruption that had claimed the roses had not spared the manor. What had once been a smooth white facade was now grey with years, streaked with the black of dirt and the green of rot. The shining pillars were twined about with dying vines, and the balconies, which Magnus remembered as like the hollows of alabaster goblets, were now filled with the dark snarls of thorns and the debris of years. The door knocker had been an image of a shining golden lion with a ring held in its mouth. Now the ring lay rotted on the step, and the grey lion's mouth hung open and empty in a hungry snarl. Magnus knocked briskly on the door. He heard the sound echo through the inside of the house as if all were the heavy silence of a tomb therein, and ever would be, as if any noise was a disturbance. The conviction that everyone in this house must be dead had gained such a hold on Magnus that it was a shock when the woman who had summoned him here opened the door. It was, of course, rather odd for a lady to be opening her own front door, but from the look of the place, Magnus assumed the entire staff of servants had been given the decade off. Magnus had a dim recollection of seeing Tatiana Lightwood at one of her father's parties, a glimpse of a perfectly ordinary girl with wide green eyes behind a hastily closing door. Even after seeing the house and the grounds, he was not prepared for Tatiana Blackthorn. Her eyes were still very green. Her stern mouth was bracketed with lines of bitter disappointment and grave pain. She looked like a woman in her 60s, not her 40s. She was wearing a gown of fashion decades past. It hung from her wasted shoulders and fluttered around her body like a shroud. The fabric bore dark brown stains, but in patches it was a faded pastel bordering on white, while the other spots remained what Magnus thought must have been its original fuchsia. She should have looked ridiculous. She was wearing a silly bright pink dress for a younger woman, someone who was almost a girl, in love with her husband and going on a visit to her papa. She did not look ridiculous. Her stern face forbade pity. She, like the house, was awe-inspiring in her ruin. "Bane," Tatiana said, and held the door open wide enough that Magnus could pass through. She said no word of welcome. She shut the door behind Magnus, the sound as final as the closing of a tomb. Magnus paused in the hall, waiting for the woman behind him, and as he waited, he heard another footstep above their heads, a sign there was someone else alive in the house. Down the wide curving staircase towards them came a girl. Magnus had always found mortals to be beautiful, and had seen many mortals whom anyone would have described as beautiful. This was extraordinary beauty, beauty unlike the beauty of most mortals. In the stained and filthy ruin the house had become, she shone like a pearl. Her hair was the color of a pearl too, palest ivory with a sheen of gold on it, and her skin was the luminous pink and white of a seashell. Her lashes were thick and dark, veiling eyes of deep, unearthly grey. Magnus drew in a breath. Tatiana heard him and looked over, smiling a triumphant smile. "She's glorious, isn't she? My ward, my grace." Grace. The realization struck Magnus like a blow. Of course James Herondale hadn't been calling out for something as inchoate and distant as a benediction. The soul's yearning for divine mercy and understanding, his desperation had been centered on something far more flesh and blood than that. But why is it a secret? Why can no one help him? Magnus struggled to keep his face a blank as the girl moved toward him and offered her hand. "How do you do?" she murmured. Magnus stared down at her. Her face was a porcelain cup upturned. Her eyes held promises. The combination of beauty, innocence, and the promise of sin was staggering. "Magnus Bane," she said in a breathy, soft voice. Magnus couldn't help staring at her. Everything about her was so perfectly constructed to appeal. She was beautiful, yes, but it was more than that. She seemed shy, yet all her attention was focused on Magnus, as if he were the most fascinating thing she had ever seen. There was no man who did not want to see himself reflected like that in a beautiful girl's eyes. And if the neckline of her dress was a shade low, it did not seem scandalous, for her gray eyes were full of an innocence that said that she did not know of desire. Not yet. But there was a lushness to the curve of her lip, a dark light in her eyes that said that under the right hands, she would be a pupil who yielded the most exquisite result. Magnus took a step back from her as if she were a poisonous snake. She did not look hurt or angry or even startled. She turned a look on Tatiana, a sort of curious inquiry. "Mama," she said, "what is wrong?" Tatiana curled her lip. "This one is not like others," she said. "I mean, he likes girls well enough, and boys as well, I hear, but his taste does not run to shadow hunters. And he is not mortal. He has been alive a long time. One cannot expect him to have the normal reactions." Magnus could well imagine what the normal reactions would be. The reactions of a boy like James Herondale, sheltered and taught that love was gentle, love was kind, that one should love with all one's heart and give away all one's soul. Magnus could imagine the normal reactions to this girl, a girl whose every gesture, every expression, every line cried, "Love her, love her, love her." But Magnus was not that boy. He reminded himself of his manners and bowed. "Charmed," he said, "or whatever effect would please you best, I'm sure." Grace regarded him with cool interest. Her reactions were muted, Magnus thought, or rather carefully gauged. She seemed a creature made to attract everyone and express nothing real, though it would take a master observer like Magnus to know it. She reminded Magnus suddenly not of any mortal, but of the vampire Camille, who had been his latest and most regrettable real love. Magnus had spent years imagining there was fire behind Camille's eyes, that there were hopes and dreams and love waiting for him. What he had loved in Camille had been nothing but illusion. Magnus had acted like a child, fancying there were shapes and stories to be made of clouds in the sky. He turned away from the sight of Grace in her trim white and blue dress, like a vision of heaven in the gray hell of this house, and looked at Tatiana. Her eyes were narrowed with contempt. "Come, warlock," she said. "I believe we have business to discuss." Magnus followed Tatiana and Grace up the stairs and down a long corridor that was almost pitch black. Magnus heard the crack and crunch of broken glass beneath his feet, and in the dim, hardly there light, he saw something scuttling away from his approach. He hoped it was something as harmless as a rat, but something about its movement suggested a shape far more grotesque. "Do not try to open any doors or drawers while you are here, Bane," Tatiana's voice floated back to him. "My father left behind many guardians to protect what is ours." She opened the door and Magnus beheld the room within. There were an upturned desk and heavy curtains sagging in the windows like bodies from a gibbet, and on the wooden floor were splinters and streaks of blood, the marks of a long-ago struggle nobody had cleaned up. There were many picture frames hanging askew or with the glass broken. A great many of them seemed to contain nautical adventures. Magnus had been put off the sea by his ill-fated attempt to live a piratical life for a day, but even the pictures that were whole were clouded with gray. The painted ships appeared to be sinking in seas of dust. There was only one portrait that was whole and clean. It was an oil painting with no glass covering it. There was not a speck of dust on its surface. It was the only clean thing besides Grace in the entire house. The portrait was of a boy about 17 years old. He was sitting in a chair, his head resting against the back as if he did not have the strength to support it on his own. He was terribly thin and as white as salt. His eyes were a deep, still green, like a woodland pool hidden under the overhanging leaves of a tree never exposed to sun or wind. He had dark hair falling as fine-spun and straight as silk across his brow, and his long fingers were curled over the arms of the chair, almost clinging to it,